Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
That's right, Joel. This is a listener question Monday episode. We've got four questions. Plus one bonus one.
Oh, I like it.
for listeners today, we have a listener who wants to make the most of a meme stock investing mistake that he made.
Okay.
A listener wants to know if an advanced degree is actually going to be worth it for them. And should a listener rent or sell his home? Plus one other question, and then plus that one bonus one, like I said. So we've got five total questions. Like we always do, actually.
Okay, so I'm wondering if that graduate degree is like advanced underwater basket weaving. Because if that's the case, I'm going to say yes, it's worth it.
Underwater basket weaving, probably not. But underwater welding, they pay big bucks.
That's true.
If that's what you do.
That's good business to get into.
But man, I wanted to share a story about an issue I had with our van. First of all, let me point out that I am not a car guy, right? Obviously, like neither one of us are really car guys. We're more into walking places and biking anyway to do it for cheaper than driving a vehicle.
On occasion.
Yeah, but whatever it takes, man. And so like, because I'm not a car guy, I'm not like a detail. Like I don't, when I wash my car, which is obviously incredibly rare, I'm not like there with the toothbrush. I'm not like detailing it, making it, you know, making it shine.
Mine is not great looking.
Yeah. So recently, I kind of put that out there because then recently I was driving around in the van and I noticed that it was like smelling really bad. You've ridden the van and you're like, oh yeah, what's that smell?
I'm
like,
a little musty.
You smell it? Like, what's going on? And I thought maybe one of the kids had left some food in the car, did a full like top to bottom search, couldn't find anything. But during the search process, I realized that the floors were kind of wet. I was like, what is going on? And then underneath the floor mats, you know, like you've got floor mats over like your entire vehicle. It was acting as a vapor barrier, essentially. And there was water trapped between our mats. And it was basically in the carpet, right? And so I did some searching online, searched on some YouTube videos. And turns out it was because of my sunroof. Sunroofs often will leak. And specifically, if the drains in the little tray that the sunroof sits in, basically, when it's closed, if that tray, there are normally at least two drains in there. And if they get clogged, it'll flood your car. And it'll lead to water getting in your floorboards. This is a problem because, obviously, I don't want to drive around in a stinky vehicle. But if it were to affect any of my electrical systems, this is going to end up costing me even more money down the road,
yeah.
Right? Like, I could ignore it, but that's not the smart thing to do, right?
It's like, hey, I got a little heart pain. I'm just going to ignore it for right now because it'll probably clear up, right?
It's like this shooting sensation up and down my arm. Like, just kind of shake it off.
Not the best move.
No, don't do that. Go see a doctor. Or in my case, look on YouTube and figure out how to clean out these drains. I figured out how to take a little bottle brush that we use to clean out Westy's, you know, his little baby bottle. His old baby bottles or whatever. But I use that. I was able to clean it out. But here's the thing, man. I did not know that those, first of all, that those drains can get clogged. And if you're like me and you park your vehicle underneath a tree, all the pollen, junk that falls from the tree, it turns into this like tree sludge and it'll get in there, it'll harden. And that's what specifically was causing the drains in our sunroof to clog. And so I used to be this guy who never paid much attention to any detailing when it came to washing my car. But now every time I wash the car, man, I'm going to make sure I pop open that sunroof and wipe down the sort of inside of the sunroof surround to make sure that no debris is getting down there in those drains, because you don't want those to overflow. So
there you go.
Yeah, if you have a sunroof, this may not be something you've ever done before, but yeah, open that sunroof, take a look on the inside of that little area there between like the headliner and the metal part of your car. You'll see, you know, where all that dust and all that debris can get in there. Wipe that down. Don't wipe the grease. You want to leave the grease there. That's good for the sunroof to like move on, you know. Leave that there, but if you see all like pollen or dirt and debris, make sure you clean that out.
There you go. Well,
this is an argument for maintenance. It's not sexy.
Well, it is.
But it's something that everyone needs to do.
It's also an argument for just researching when there's a problem, because that's what's, again, what's so great about the internet, what's so great about YouTube, is that other people have had problems like yours, right?
Yeah.
Like my Honda Odyssey is, which is named Homer, is like when I started.
Did I say the name of mine?
No, yours is Hal.
Hal. Yeah, Hal and Homer. Yeah. These are names that were given to our vans by our listeners.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so when I start mine, it takes like 3 or 4 seconds sometimes to get going. And I was,
you got an older van.
Yeah. So yeah, I by doing some research, it looks like it's a faulty ignition relay, and, okay. it looks like it's not a terribly difficult fix. And I've got to do that in, you know, the coming weeks. But yeah, it's one of those things where I could take that into a mechanic, and just the diagnosis itself could potentially cost me, you know, over $100. And I'm not saying there's not a place for mechanics. I drive an older vehicle, and I am more than willing to take it to a mechanic for lots of things. But some of those things, like what you experience, like what I'm experiencing, you know, they are easy enough to at least pinpoint the problem and then figure out whether or not you're going to be able to tackle it on your own. And and in your case, yeah, a little bottle brush did
that's
the
all
trick.
It took. Yeah, that put some, like, and once I cleared it out, got some hot water in there and kind of poured it through, and you can literally see, like, or from my problem here, you can see where it drains out into the wheel wells. And so at first it was totally like impacted, like water wasn't flowing, but after I got it going, man, it felt so good just to see that water like trickle through, because it's designed to kind of like flow through the vehicle basically. Yeah. But yeah, hearing you talk about your starter problem, it just made me think too, like, what if you could get a mechanic on the phone and just be like, all right, listen, I'm gonna do it now. like teledoc style.
Yeah.
But like a telemechanic, like a telemech. I don't know if that exists.
Because when you actually physically take it in, the problem is never reveals itself the way you've been experiencing
it.
The
mechanic's
like, I don't know, it looks fine to me.
But no, I swear, this happens in my driveway.
And they're like, sure it does.
Yeah, but yeah, if there's any mechanics out there who haven't done that, that might be a good way. Because like, if they were able to diagnose it and they're like, yep, we can order that part, it's like, man, that just saved me an entire trip. That inconvenience is oftentimes what I'm trying to avoid, at least.
No doubt. All right, well, let's move on, Matt. Let's get to the questions, our listener questions for this episode. But before that, we'll just mention the beer. We're having a beer by Weldworks Brewing. It's a double dry hopped IPA called Juicy Bits. And so, yeah, we'll give our thoughts on this beer at the end of the episode.
Yeah.
But for now, on to listener questions. And if you are listening and you've got a money question for Matt and I, we'd love to take it on an upcoming episode. You can submit that at howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple instructions. You record a voice memo, then you email it over to us, and then we hopefully feature it here like we're going to do with this first question about how we can make money less stressful in our lives.
Hi, Matt and Joel. My name is Victoria, and I'm currently living in Columbus, Ohio. I have been through almost all of your episodes and would like to thank you so much for empowering me on my financial journey. So my question to you is how to make allocating my money less stressful. I'm good at living within my budget and paying off all my bills, loans, and debts on time, but it takes a lot of planning each paycheck to make sure I don't accidentally overdraft my checking account. I keep a low balance in there after taking care of all my expenses, including sometimes paying off my credit cards more than once a month. I get paid bi-weekly every other Friday, and I think one of the main problems is that my expenses lean heavier in the beginning of the month with my rent payment. It is also hard to decide when to transfer chunks of money into my emergency funds, Roth IRA, or other savings accounts. I do all of my payments manually right now. I'm nervous that if I switch over to automatic payments on everything, I'll accidentally overdraft my checking because I don't have enough money at the time of the month, depending on when each payment is. In addition, I'm nervous that if I have everything automated and not check in on my finances, my spending may go awry and I'll slowly lose money by not having to physically pay everything each month. I'd really appreciate your feedback and tips on how to manage my stress about my money allocations. Keep up with providing quality content and stay safe.
All right, Victoria, this is a great question. And we talked about money stress recently back on episode 371.
We had kind of a positive spin on stress.
We tried to, at least, yeah. Because some stress can be useful, right? It can lead to you getting organized with your money. And folks are likely going to see higher levels of performance because of the goals that they may have set. But, of course, being stressed out over money consistently isn't good, of course. It can potentially lead to poor money habits in addition to just health and relational hardships that you might experience because of a lack of money or poor money management. But the good news in your case, Victoria, is that it sounds like that you are being very organized, right? It seems like you know exactly where your money is going. You've got a handle on your expenses. It's just that it is stressing you out. And I think we might have a solution for you.
Yeah, let's talk about how we can help Victoria be less stressed about her money. And it seems like the biggest source of Victoria's anxiety here is that, at least from where we're sitting, based on your question, based on listening to a minute of you talking, Victoria, you might be living paycheck to paycheck, right? Like, and if that's the case, if your company didn't make payroll for some reason on Friday, it sounds like you'd be in a really, really tough spot. And so we would say it's really crucial to increase the gap between what's incoming and what's outgoing, right? So yeah, if you're worried about overdrafting your account, that means you don't have quite enough money in there. So there are really two ways that you can create more financial margin in your life, right? You either make more money or you spend less money.
Yeah, those are the two levers that you can pull.
Yeah, it's not really all that complex when it comes down to it. But one other thing we wanted to mention is, and this doesn't necessarily actually technically fall into either, but it's the first obvious thing that stood out, is that you mentioned that you're contributing to your Roth IRA. Normally, this is a good thing, and Matt and I encourage people contributing to Roth IRAs.
We love Roth IRAs.
It's very rare that you'll hear us say, don't do that, or it's a bad idea. But we would actually rather see you put less money right now towards your investing for the time being, and more towards savings until you can comfortably start contributing to that Roth again. For you, increasing margin is the most important thing, and investing can come just a little bit further down the road.
Yeah, over a longer time horizon, we'd encourage you to try and pull both of those levers, right? Either making more or spending less in order to increase your financial margin. But for now, simply putting your investments on hold, like, that should allow you to immediately gain some traction, and that's what we're looking for in your case. And we think that that should help reduce your stress levels by being able to put some of those payments on auto payment, because you'll know that you'll have enough to cover them, right? And you know, even if you're not set up on auto payments, just having enough money in the bank will allow you to implement your own personal systems for what bills you pay on what dates. We don't want you to have to actively decide when you're going to pay bills or when it is that you're going to invest chunks of your money. And we want that to be a little more passive, a little more automatic. And even just a repeating monthly calendar reminder, say on the third Friday of that month, can be a good prompt for you to invest. That's a good way to automate and just get it off your mind. But of course, make sure that you don't do that until you have that financial margin set up. But essentially, when you have more margin in your life, that's going to lead you to be able to take advantage of more automation, which should decrease the levels of stress that you're experiencing. And also, you know, one other side thing, switch to a bank that doesn't charge overdraft fees. Ally Bank is a bank that recently did away with those completely. That way, if it happens to be a crazy month and you maybe have a few more expenses than normal and that biweekly check just hasn't been deposited yet, you're not going to incur those overdraft charges every single time. That's something that we're glad to see Ally leading the way on.
Yeah, yeah. Those overdraft fees can be like the sword of Damocles hanging over your head, and you're like, oh no! Like, if I make this one spend, it could potentially result in a $35 charge, and that's a lot of money, especially if you're living paycheck to paycheck. But yeah, Matt, I agree. The more margin you have, the more you can automate, because you know that the money's in there. You don't have to be worried about that. And so, yeah, Victoria, it's not that we don't want you investing towards your retirement, but we want to make sure that you're doing things in the right order. And this is exactly actually what we talked about when we introduced our Money Gears episode. That was 302, beginning of this year. You can either go listen to that one, or you can quickly read the high points on the Start Here page of our website at howtomoney.com. But the very first thing you should do is to make sure that you have an emergency fund of at least $2,467. It's a very specific number. If you want to know more about that, you can go back and check that episode out. But you did mention that you're putting money towards an emergency fund. So that's awesome that you're prioritizing it, at least in some to some degree. But maybe a simple way that you can use that to lessen stress is simply by moving it over to your checking account instead of having it in a separate savings account, right? That way your emergency fund can act as this like cushion between getting paid and some big expenses like a rent or mortgage payment, you know, at least until you have enough saved that you can transfer that over to savings and you've got enough in both accounts. But really the big goal right here is more financial margin, more liquid cash sitting in your accounts so that you don't have to be worried about any individual bill coming in. You want to get to the point where you're using last month's money to pay this month's bills. And once you get to that point, that's when you have margin. And that's when you can say, all right, you know what? I think maybe I'm ready to dip my toes back into investing a little more regularly because I'm not stressed about money every day or every week. And yeah, I mean, I feel like Victoria can get there and will get there. It's just going to take some intentionality right now and kind of, shifting some things around.
Yeah, that's right. Victoria, essentially, we want to get you off of that knife's edge where one misstep would wreck your finances. And kind of going back to what Joel was saying too about making sure that you're doing these money moves in the right order. This is something we've talked on the show about before, but maybe it's worth mentioning again. I've made this exact same mistake. Back when I was first learning about personal finances, I had heard the power of investing. And a friend of mine was like, you've got to get that compounding interest working in your favor. And I said, yeah, you're right. And so I dumped a ton of money into my Roth IRA before my personal finances were in good order. And it turns out that I needed that money a few months later, and taking money out of a volatile market just after a few months is not ideal. And so that's not the situation that we want you in, Victoria, were you to need that money. Obviously, we don't want you to go in debt, but we also don't want you to take money out of your Roth IRA.
Yeah, a good money move isn't necessarily a good move if it's done in the wrong order.
Yep. Then it's a bad money move.
Then it's a bad money move. Even though it's a laudable thing that you're attempting to, you'll get there soon. You'll get there soon.
Yeah.
So, all right, we got more questions to get to, including one about selling or renting a home. Which one should this listener choose? We'll get to that and more right after this break.
All right, we are back, and we're going to take a question here about some money relational advice. But before we get to that one, let's take this question about whether this listener should sell or rent his home.
This is Pete from San Diego. I'm currently in the Navy, and my wife and I have owned a home here since 2012. We are scheduled to transfer to Washington State in a few months and are trying to decide whether to rent or sell before moving. There is a chance we could come back to San Diego. It would be nice to have a house, but also a chance we would never come back. So we are concerned about renting a place that we live so far away from for possibly many years. Furthermore, the market in San Diego is really hot right now, and if we listed, we could get top dollar for our place, roughly $250,000 profit after selling, or with renting, about a $1,000 profit per month. We have considered a property manager if we rent because we are inexperienced, but have a lot of family in the area that would be willing to look after the place at no cost if we did rent it ourselves. We would love some advice from you fine folks about if we should rent or sell to help make our decision a little bit easier. Thanks for all you do, and I can't wait to hear from you. P.S. What is your favorite double IPA?
All right, Matt. Pete's toughest question there. What's your favorite double IPA? That's a difficult one.
That is tough. I mean, anything that's double dry hopped, and so I'm actually quite fond of the beer that we're currently drinking. But I'm thinking of Burial. They've got a lot of double dry hop, double IPAs. Toppling Goliath. They make some really solid ones as well. But I mean, I know it's tough to narrow it down to a particular beer because a lot of them are similar. There's different breweries that make just really high caliber double IPAs. But I will narrow that down to double dry hopped IPAs specifically. Those are my jam.
There we go. All right, I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've said the most like visceral flavor profile.
It's so
right?
good.
Let's get to Pete's actual question, right? Let's talk about housing. And normally, Pete, we would tell you to sell when you're in the military and you're moving because becoming a default long distance landlord is not really ideal. There's a lot of potential pitfalls, there's a lot of downsides to that. But the fact that you might move back, I would say, is one check mark at least in favor of potentially holding on to that home. You know, having family in the area is another positive in favor of keeping that home. One, it means you're more likely to move back there, and two, it means you might have some help looking after it. But ultimately, Matt and I would say there's just too many X factors to make keeping this house a really great decision for you.
Yeah, too many unknown variables. And so, Pete, since it sounds like this would be your first rental property and you're going to be living hundreds of miles away, it sounds like getting a property manager would actually make the most sense for you in order for this to be successful. Yeah, you did mention having family in town, and while that's, you know, that's good that they'd be able to keep an eye on the place, like, I wouldn't actually want any family members managing a property unless that was their job or unless they had experience maybe with their own rentals. I think having a family member that has zero experience with tenants, like, that kind of sounds like a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, they get the call or the email and they're like, oh, I don't know.
We'll do it. We'll fix it. And yeah. It's just like, oh, actually, no, we're not supposed to fix that. Like, that's their fault or whatever the situation might be. You want to have somebody who knows what they're doing on the other end of those calls from your tenants. That's when having a property manager makes sense. But hiring a property manager, of course, is going to eat into that monthly cash flow from the property. Typically, that is all or half of the first month's rent, and then 10% of the monthly rent moving forward. And so if you really want to maintain that property, if you want to keep it, because there's a good chance you'll be moving back, that would be the route to go. But otherwise, that's a really steep cost to maintain something that maybe you don't even really care about all that much.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Pete needs to be actually pretty certain that he's going to move back and that he loves this house enough that he wants to move back into that particular home in order to rent this property out. The desire has to be not necessarily to make money as a landlord, but to keep the house that you want to live in again a few years down the road.
Yeah, if you know the neighborhood, you have neighbors who are good friends there, and you're like, okay, I would 100% want to move right back to this exact spot, you know, in a couple years.
And it's likely, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so what you just mentioned though, Matt, that's one strike against renting it out, right? Having to hire a property manager,
and it costs money.
It's going to cost money. Another reason is that Pete's home has increased in value a lot, right? And so the fact that this home is probably an expensive home makes it unlikely that it's going to be an awesome rental property too, right? The numbers often work better for landlords who own and lease out homes that are on the less expensive side, right? Like, typically, numbers work out better on a rental home that costs $200,000 than a rental home that costs $500,000, right?
Exactly. Or, and even better if it costs even less than $200,000.
Right, yeah. If somehow you can buy a house that costs $120,000 and you can rent it out, you know, for $1,200, that's when the numbers are great. That's the rule of thumb we're trying to hit, is the 1% rule of thumb, although much harder to come by these days. So, yeah, if your home has gained that much value, it could be worth like over $500,000 or maybe even close to $750,000. And in that case, it's probably not going to make for a great rental property. Expensive homes just aren't usually ideal for renting because of that weaker profit margin.
That's right. And Pete, you know, let's talk about the other probably biggest downside to keeping this home as a rental. You mentioned that your home has already skyrocketed in value, right? Like you're looking at $250,000 in profit. That's pretty incredible. Congrats. And if you rent it out for several years after that, and then you decide to sell it, you're going to be subject to paying capital gains tax on the entire value increase of the home. And so were you to sell now, that will allow you to pocket the gains tax free since you've occupied it as your primary residence, at least two of the past 5 years. And so you don't want to let taxes completely drive your decision. But in this case, you know, that's a pretty good reason to sell if you're not gung-ho on becoming a landlord as well. I guess alternatively, if you are pretty interested in kind of renting the property out, give it a shot. Maybe give it a couple of years, but you need to make that decision before you get to that third year, because if you're kind of on the fence about being a landlord, you want to make sure that you sell it within that third year. That way you're still able to not pay any capital gains tax. And in the meantime too, I guess in those 2 or 3 years, hopefully you'll have seen the value of that home continue to rise, although that's not necessarily guaranteed.
Yeah, Matt, I agree. I think maybe giving it a 2-year trial is kind of the perfect route to go if Pete thinks he's going to move back into the home and really desires to move back there too, because you can see how's it going. Like, is this long distance landlording thing working out well for me? Is it profitable? And do we actually think that we're gonna move back into the area at some point? And 2 years is that perfect timeline, because if you're like, you know, it looks like we're not moving back and it's not really ideal, then you can pull the trigger and sell and you can still avoid the massive tax hit.
Yes.
You know,
that's the big thing you want to make sure you avoid.
Yeah. That timeline, that clock's ticking once you move out of the house. So just got to be cognizant of that. But Pete, best of luck to you. I guess I don't know if we have gave you like a firm decision one way or the other, but yeah, the trial period might make the most sense. But I guess one other little con to that would be when you're living in it, you can present it in the perfect way to buyers. And then there's a lot of work that to staging and getting the home ready after you've had other tenants in there. So there's a lot of variables here, but Pete, we trust you to make the best decision with kind of all the information we've laid out, and best of luck to you and your fam. All right, Matt, let's get to the next question. This one is about having difficult money conversations with your partner.
Hi guys, this is Leslie calling from Leavenworth, Kansas with a relational money question. I appreciate how you guys understand that that's an important part of personal finance, so I'd love to hear what you have to say. Recently, I told my husband that I thought it was time for us to open a taxable brokerage account. We're in Money Gear 7. He really wasn't very enthusiastic about the idea, and when I asked him why, he made some vague comments about disliking the economic system or not wanting to be part of the system. We agreed to sit down at a later point when neither one of us is stressed or holding a baby and talk about things more. But I'm really not sure what to ask him during that conversation. I know this is a big picture conversation, more about the why behind your money. But if I just sit down and say, what's the why behind your money? I'm not going to get anywhere. My husband is really responsible with his money, but he hates talking about it or even really thinking about it. And I just want to see if we can get on the same page better, or at least understand where he's coming from. So I'd love to get your tips on what questions to ask so that we can really get to understanding each other better. Thanks, guys.
All right, Leslie, congrats on being in Money Gear number 7. That is a huge accomplishment, so congrats there. And yes, definitely have this convo when you're not in a stressful situation. You know, the setting matters a whole lot in being able to have just a reasonable conversation without your emotions flaring. I'll be honest, you know, I love my kids, but it's pretty much impossible for Kate and I to have a conversation, a healthy conversation about anything important when all the kiddos are awake, running around, pulling on us, interrupting. That's something we're working on. It's like, are mommy and daddy talking? Then you cannot interrupt unless like something's on fire.
Dada, where's my water?
And so, yeah, post bedtime or date night is definitely when we prioritize having those conversations. You know, look to find ways to make those conversations fun. It sounds like he does not like talking about money. And so if he likes craft beer, maybe crack open a bottle of something really tasty. Or if he likes being outdoors, try to incorporate that with his money conversations. Look to different ways you can make it as enjoyable as possible.
Yeah, get him in his comfort zone. And that's definitely a good way to approach it. I'd also, Leslie, come at this conversation with some curiosity. Because honestly, like based on what you said, I'm pretty curious now. Like I kind of want to talk to him and you know get his ideas. Like,
yeah,
what is it about the system that he dislikes? Or is it like the idea of capitalism in general? Or is it just like more like the consumerism that's run amok in our country? Because, yeah, I mean, Matt and I were fans of the free market economy that we live in. But that doesn't mean that there aren't issues and concerns. And so, yeah, those pop up and they can maybe change how we feel about the moves that we're making with our money. But, yeah, there are healthy ways to invest without feeling like you're forced to support companies that you have a real issue with as well. So that's kind of where maybe those curious questions can kind of bring forth maybe some of those bigger things that he's feeling. And yeah, like when it comes down to it, that's a big reason why something like ESG investing has become so big over the last 5 years. Those are the funds that prioritize investing in a socially responsible way, environmental, social, and governance concerns. And yeah, now there are reasonably inexpensive funds that allow you to invest in that way. So if that is the reason, and again, it's hard to know, right, until you dig in a little bit more and ask him some of those curious questions. But yeah, it could be something as simple as that. Some of my money that I'm investing is going to these companies that are doing things that I don't like. And it's like, well, actually, there's ways around that now. There might be easy solutions to some of the things that he's feeling.
Yeah, it could just be a nuts and bolts kind of conversation, right? Yeah. But then, Leslie, you know, since both of you have done so well with your money, you know, maybe he's hoping to invest a little less because he wants to enjoy some of the fruits of your mutual labor now, right? And so focusing that conversation on the future that the money that you invest today, that will be funding, is going to be a really important aspect of that conversation. I don't think most folks naturally gravitate towards investing huge loads of money for the future, and it often doesn't help, even when we're told to do so because it's just like the quote-unquote smart thing to do.
It's
right?
Like that busy work when you were in school, and yeah, you're like,
oh, you should just do this because you should do this.
Because there's 20 minutes left in the period, yeah. Okay? And we're not going to let you just play.
Yeah. We need more than that. We need a larger goal. And so making sure that it's included in this conversation, these larger goals, could really help you guys to dream together about the future in a positive way. It can make that decision to invest feel like something that you're doing on purpose instead of that you're just doing the responsible thing because you're supposed to. You want to find ways to link that money that you're socking away to whatever future goals that you both are striving after.
Yeah, I feel like on purpose is just the biggest two words there for every investor, for everybody handling their personal finances, right? Having that why behind you really helps fuel you in the right direction. And so what that looks like is to make those goals as tangible as possible, right? Like you mentioned, asking him what this big why behind his money, it might be too grand of a question to ask initially.
Yeah, it's pretty nebulous.
Yeah,
it's like, what's your why behind your money? It's like, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And unless you've listened to that episode, unless you've heard us talk about it, I think a lot of folks are probably like, huh? Like that, they just kind of like stare at you with blank eyes.
Yeah,
right?
So you got to ask like smaller questions to kind of pinpoint that why, right? You kind of drive the conversation towards that. And so instead of asking him that, maybe ask him what he'd like his ideal calendar to look like.
Yeah, get practical about it. Yeah. Like, what do you want your days to look like?
What do you want your weeks to look like? What do you want your weekends to look like? Or like even just your mornings. Do you want less work in your life? Do you want more time to go for hikes or bike rides? Or what is it that's kind of motivating you? And then find the way that the money intersects that, right? Because like investing so that we can have financial freedom, it sounds kind of boring and it sounds kind of lifeless.
Yeah.
And so you have to bring life to that in your own marriage, in your own personal life. Because investing so that in the future you can achieve those goals, you can travel abroad with your kids for, you know, weeks at a time, take a sabbatical, or so that you can even do something like transitioning to a lower paying but more fulfilling career that is less demanding. Like those are the kinds of discussions that are going to add some color to that conversation. It's less about like, well, when do we want to achieve financial independence? Because that's a boring conversation that I don't ever want to have with my wife. But yeah, talking about those goals that we have, the more exciting things to where we're investing for something specific that's going to make our lives better and achieve achieve some of those bigger goals that we have for ourselves, like those are the exciting things to talk about.
Absolutely. And maybe Leslie too, like for him, maybe it's about like, maybe he feels slightly guilty for the success that y'all have had. And so maybe what that means is giving more of your money away. Like maybe there's a place for that charitable giving. And so through your conversations that you're going to have with him, hopefully you can kind of get to the root of what it is that he wants his life and he wants y'all's life to look like as a couple, as a family in the future. And so best of luck with this conversation. And we hope you enjoy it, you know, like have fun as you talk about your future together. Like this should be inspirational. It shouldn't feel like homework. It should more feel like you won a prize and now you're going to decide which prize you're going to pick, because that's what it is that you're going to be seeking after. But also, obviously, you've got your own views and your own goals, but, you know, be curious about his point of view as well. And, you know, either route you take, your family's going to be fine, because it sounds like you've been making really smart money decisions with your money for a long time now. You're on Money Gear number 7. We're really proud of y'all. And I hope this is something that you and your husband are able to figure out soon.
And yeah, sometimes just acknowledging that, realizing that your options are pretty wide open because you've handled money well for so long, can really help like ease the stress of that conversation too. It's like, hey, we actually have a lot of options here. Just acknowledging those options, even at the beginning of the conversation and the success you've had, I think can really help kickstart that conversation in a good way too.
Absolutely. So we are going to take a quick break, but after that, we've got our last two questions. We're going to get to that question about making the most of that big investing mistake, specifically when it comes to cryptocurrencies and meme stocks. We're going to get to that one plus one other right after this break.
All right, we're back. And Matt, it's now time to talk about, what do you do after you've made an investing screw up? We've got a listener who did that very thing, and he's got some questions about how to rebound. Well, let's get to that now.
Hey, Joel and Matt. Edgar from Omaha, Nebraska here. I hope you can help me make the best out of a terrible financial mistake. For some background, I decided to quit my job and sell my house in early 2019 to start my own project. In March of 2020, I invested about 7K in Bitcoin when it was in a slump, and I didn't really think about it much. By the end of January 2021, though, it had grown about 30K. This is when I done goofed. I moved all my Bitcoin fund money into GameStop, and well, you know how that ended. I lost about 20K of my investment. While I'm not destitute, I still have a nice savings account, 20K in stock options, and a 401k I ain't touching. I decided to work with my parents to make some extra money to keep me going for a while longer. Is there anything I can do to make the best out of my loss, whether through taxes or something else? I wish I could have been listening to you guys earlier this year and maybe avoided all of this. Thank you.
All right, Matt, first things first, when it comes to Edgar's question, I have to say to Edgar, stop beating yourself up, man, because I feel like that's probably the worst thing you can do after you've made a mistake. It's just to replay it over and over in your head, right? Like just giving yourself crap for having made a mistake, because we have all made mistakes, and the key is learning from that mistake and not letting it define you.
Yeah, that actually makes me think of a recent Loki episode where he had to relive this bad decision that he made over and over, not unlike what you were just saying. Edgar, don't be like Loki in this case. But the other thing here to make sure that you're doing is to just make sure that you learn from this experience, right? Like it sounds like you have, but investing in the hyped up cryptocurrencies that are the latest and greatest out there, or the different meme stocks of the moment, can have real consequences. The different headlines that you read will make it seem like a bunch of folks are getting rich and that you're the only one sitting out on the sidelines, but that's just not true. And so we want you to do whatever it takes to turn off the different noisy inputs, you know, like the different subreddits that might be encouraging you to invest in something just because a small group of folks have deemed it to be the stock of the moment. This is all what we're going to throw our collective weight behind. Diamond hands to the moon, whatever terminology they use. I don't know, because Joel and I, we're not into that. But that's what folks are doing. And that type of investing is pure speculation.
Yeah. And all the headlines we see, often there's a profile of somebody that has made out like a bandit. Yeah. But there's just so many more people like you, Edgar, in your position who end up being hurt in the aftermath of something like investing in a meme stock. So yeah, but how can you potentially turn this mistake into your advantage besides just learning from it? Well, yeah, I think one, it's important to transition from the way you're kind of trading stocks now, which we would say is more speculative, and get more comfortable with the idea of getting rich slowly, right? That's the ulcer-free way to invest, which I don't personally want to have health problems due to the way I'm investing. I don't want to be super stressed out about it.
Don't have to pay for it with your body. I was moving some stumps around the other day, and I kind of stumbled and I jammed my finger. It's still like, look how fat and swollen it is. It's been like weeks. That's not the kind of thing I want to deal with anymore.
in your 20s, that wouldn't have been the case.
Yeah, in my 20s, I would have bounced back. But now that I'm in my 30s, I'm like, ouchie. Like, it's still bothering me.
Well, but yeah, one other way for Edgar to make lemonade out of lemons here is to do some tax loss harvesting, right? Edgar, if you have other investments that have made a solid return, right, you can sell both your winners and your losers in the same calendar year. And that allows you to at least offset some of the tax that you would have paid from the winners if you were to sell them in, let's say, separate calendar years. So that's one thing that you can do, one, you know, tax move that you can do that maybe at least lessens the blow a little bit.
That's right. Yeah. So Edgar, in your case, like, it sounds like you head on to your Bitcoin for less than a year. If you purchased in March of 2020, you sold it in January 2021. That's not 12 months. And so you're realizing a short-term capital gain. But then you bought AMC. And since you said that you lost 20K, I'm guessing that you sold, which means that you've realized a short-term loss. And so, though it never feels good to lose money ever, right, you can take maybe some solace in knowing that your gains and your losses might effectively cancel each other out, and you'll likely have to pay the IRS very little in taxes. But that being said, since we don't know what your income is, do make sure that you consult short and long-term capital gains rate charts, so that way you know you're reporting the right numbers to the IRS.
Yeah, and moving forward too, right? We would suggest to everyone, and to you also, Edgar, to invest no more than 5% of your total investment dollars in speculative assets like meme stocks and crypto. And actually, Matt, I mean, I know you own a little crypto, but for most folks, 0% is often better, because that means you're not obsessing over the movements of one or two companies or one or two cryptocurrencies that you're invested in. I personally don't want that stuff taking up any space in my brain. And I know myself. I know if I go down that rabbit hole of speculating, even with just this tiny portion of my money, even if really comparatively, if I lost it all, it doesn't have much of an impact on my life, I'll still be checking it every day. And I think that's true for most people who dabble in these things. They're really in it for the day-to-day moments. They're less in it for the decades. And so it does take up an inordinate amount of brain space. Yeah, that's just not really for me, because I'd rather have mental bandwidth to go towards the other most important things in life. And so, yeah, investing in that way is just something that we would suggest not doing much of, if any of it at all, in the future. Stick more to index funds, total stock market index funds, or the S&P 500 index fund, or a target date retirement fund. They're super boring, but you're also not going to see the crazy ups and downs and severe losses of money that you've seen either.
Yeah, I will say, in defense of Edgar a little bit, because he did actually call, or he called it his play money, basically. And so that, like, I find some encouragement there, knowing that, and he also did mention too, he's got that 401k that he's not planning on touching. So
true, yeah.
Makes it sound like he does have a solid, massive portfolio, and that this wasn't too much money for him. But yeah.
It was money maybe that he was willing to risk. But even still, it's like, I can't believe I lost it all, right? Yeah, that's still a tough
you
thing.
You need to be willing to invest money or to play around with money, that if you lost it all, that it wouldn't really bother you that much. It can't be money that you're counting on. And it also helps too if you're kind of like a robot like me, where you can just like turn off your emotions and refuse to check where Bitcoin and where Ethereum is, because I've got money in both of those, and I literally don't know where they are until sometimes you'll mention it, Joel. You're like, oh man, have you seen it dropped like 10% today? I'm like, oh, well, I didn't know that, but thanks for telling me.
I personally think I'm more interested in your play money portfolio than you are.
You care more about it than I do. Whereas my approach, I've got 5% of my overall portfolio in cryptocurrencies, but I'm not going to even really sit down and look at the numbers for a full year. And so if that sounds like something that you're capable of doing, maybe that's an option for you. But for everyone else, it definitely pays to know yourself. And it may not be something you want to dabble in at all if you know it's going to stress you out. All right, let's get to our last question. And this one is coming from a listener, and they're trying to decide if this extra degree, if it's going to be worth it. So let's hear that one now.
Hey, How to Money. This is Matt in Rochester, New York. I'm a big fan of the show. My wife is looking to go back to school, get her master's in child development. It's going to be about $50,000, which we're able to fund with the sale price of our house. So no loans. That's good. My question is, how do we know how long it's going to take to recoup this $50,000 with an increase in her salary. I feel like maybe about 2 years ago, you had a guest on a show, and there was a score that was calculated that looked at the cost of education compared to the increased cost in salary after that education is completed, and it came up with a nice little score. Maybe you can point me back in that direction, or do you have any other resources I can take a look at? Thanks.
Oh, Matt, this is a good question. Getting an advanced degree, when does it pay off, or when is it just too much money you shouldn't be paying? That's a good question.
That's a good question.
$50,000, that's not cheap. But also at the same time, we're so glad, Matt, that you're able to pay for that education without taking on any additional debt, right? This is just such a big accomplishment. So kudos to both of you. We're big fans of debt-free education. It's certainly not doable for everyone, but the fact that you guys are going to be able to fully fund it with cash on hand is just a huge step in the right direction, because you're not paying additional interest on that $50,000, and that's big.
Exactly. Yeah. And before we get even more serious with it, did it sound like Matt, like he totally sounded like David Harbour to me.
From Stranger Things?
Yeah. Jim Hopper is his character in Stranger Things. Didn't he kind of sound like that? He's got that that vibe going on.
Is there another Stranger Things season coming out? I hope so.
Season 4, it's been on hold. I have no idea where it is, but I need it in my life.
Me too.
But Matt, you know, you're right. You know, we did talk about how to assess the value of a college degree quite a while back with Christy Shen. That was back in episode 118. She totally rocks, and she's got this really incredible story about growing up in poverty in China before she immigrated to Canada. But she calls this her POT score, or her POT score, which stands for pay over tuition. And Christy says that you take the median starting salary that you can expect to earn above minimum wage and then divide it by the total tuition cost of the degree. This gives you a single number that you can use to rank whether a degree is worth the amount of money that you'd be paying to get it. And so, if it takes you more than 10 years to pay back that advanced degree, we feel that it's likely not worth it.
Yeah, if you're going to be able to pay it back in 2 to 3 years, and that's a pretty good POT score. Yeah. But if the earnings
aren't going to... That's a bit more reasonable.
Yeah, if the earnings aren't going to justify themselves, and it's going to take a decade or longer, then you're like, maybe I should rethink this this future course. And you're also having to estimate what your future earnings are going to be. Like, what do most people in this profession, after they get this degree, what are they earning? And so, I think it is a great formula. It's really crucial to know what your wife's likely salary is going to be in the years following getting that degree, because it gives you that information that you need, right? So if you're going into it blind, you're like, you have no idea. So you have to do some research on that front. But advanced degrees can make a big difference in the income that you're going to be able to make. And it can mean more income for decades. And so, especially, the younger you are, the more use in all likelihood you're going to get out of that advanced degree. So we're actually having to do something similar, because my wife is planning to go back to school to get a counseling degree. Yeah. And this is something that we've been talking about since before we even got married. And now it's kind of like, all right, why have we been waiting this long? Let's do it. And so it's actually going to happen. And it's a bit harder for us to figure out, because she doesn't have a job currently where she's earning an income. So we're kind of saying, like, well, what would you be making right now? And what, will you be making after this, after you've earned this degree? But we're kind of comparing it to the job that she had before we had kids. And it looks like comparatively that this degree will pay off in 4 or so years. But it's also crucial to note that the different careers provide different fulfillment for all of us too, right? Like, for our family, even if it took longer to make money back on that degree, it would be worth it, because my wife, she's basically born to be a counselor. Like, she's really good at it. She loves it. And this line of work is going to be just incredibly fulfilling. And so sometimes it goes beyond the dollars and the cents. Like, you want the dollars and the cents to work out. But if you have the money and you don't have to take on debt to fund this, you do have at least a little more freedom to say, well, how fulfilling is this career path going to be? And even if the POT score isn't the best, right, you can still justify it based on some of that other rationale.
Yeah. So that POT score, the POT score, like, it's really great too when you're starting from scratch and you're considering like multiple different degrees that have wildly different costs and starting salaries as well. But, when you already have a path forward that you really want to pursue, we feel it's crucial to know how long that payback of the degree is likely to take. And then as a family, like, you're just going to have to decide yourselves, whether or not this makes sense as you take into account all the different goals and the things that y'all have in mind. Because, like in Joel's example here with his wife, that counseling degree is going to mean a lot to Emily. But if there's someone out there considering that same degree and they don't really care what it is they're pursuing, well, then in that case, it would come down more to the numbers than anything else, because it's not something that they're going to be gaining personal fulfillment from if they're not really interested in the self-development that they're going to be gaining with that as well. So there are a lot of different factors at play here. You got to keep all of those things in mind. We wish you the best of luck in making this decision, Matt. The numbers are important, but it's not always about the numbers.
No doubt. And having the cash on hand to pay for it definitely de-stresses the choice a little bit, right? The decision. It makes it a little easier to kind of pursue what you want when you can do it without taking on debt, right? It gives you the freedom to say, I'm making a choice for myself. And hopefully it also, that choice that's fulfilling also ends up becoming more lucrative at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. What if Emily was like, hey, I really want to take out a Parent Plus loan for that counseling degree?
Well, that would be for a child. And like, yeah, I guess, you know, maybe, well, no, because even when our kids are older, if they want that, we'll find another way to pay for it.
Parent Plus loans
are the worst.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
No. All right, let's get back to the beer that we had on this episode, Matt. This was El Dorado Double Dry Hopped Juicy Bits from Weldworks Brewing Company. This is a brewery out of Colorado that just started distributing here in Atlanta. So I picked these up at our favorite local bottle shop. What was your take on this IPA, man?
So stinking good. We've actually had one of their beers before because they've done a collaboration with one of our favorite local brewers here, Monday Night Brewing. But is there a way to describe a beer both as juicy but also dry? Because I feel like that's what's going on here, because they've got the double dry hopped action going on. And so people are going to just be bored of us talking about double dry hopped IPAs. But they're so stinking good. They've got that bitter kind of blue cheesy note from the hops, but at the same time, just the kind of citrus juicy lushness that you get from this beer at the same time is just so good. I'm a huge fan of this beer, and if you can get your hands on it, I would totally recommend it.
Yeah, I feel like the aftertaste is incredible. This beer is like a little pungent, but in a good way.
Oh yeah.
And I feel like a washcloth that's soaking up some water. That's the way my tongue feels with this beer. It feels like it's like infusing my tongue. And
I'm becoming one with the beer.
Yeah, I guess
one with the juicy bits.
Turning into that beer.
Your tongue is just a juicy bit. But
that's what it begins to feel like after a while drinking this beer.
Absolutely.
It's just kind of like that concentrated. So yeah, I liked it a lot and look forward to hopefully getting more Weldworks beers on the shelves here in Atlanta.
Yeah, and I'm sure our listeners are ready to hear us get different types of beers in our beer cooler down here in the podcast studio. Maybe we'll try to include some of the different varieties of beers that are out there. I feel like we try to mix it up, but it's also hard not to pick up a good looking double dry hopped IPA, right?
That's true. Yeah, it's like my hand automatically reaches for
it. It's the default.
Yeah. All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode, Matt. For listeners who want show notes to some of the resources that we mentioned in this episode, you can find those up on our website at howtomoney.com.
And maybe like Leslie, you want to talk more about money with your spouse. Well, here is an easy, surefire, fun way to get them talking about money. Just grab their phone. Of course, you know their code. Hop on there, go to their podcast, wherever they listen to podcasts, search How to Money, and subscribe them to the show.
Oh, there you go.
That's just a nice way to to introduce the conversation of personal finance in a fun, relatable way.
How did this podcast get into my rotation?
Like, oh, I don't know. Must have been just some sort of software update that happened.
Serendipity.
Yeah, exactly. No, but if you are listening to this podcast for the first time, we would love it if you did subscribe so that you didn't miss any future episodes. And yeah, maybe it is worth considering getting someone you love to subscribe to our show as well. We want everyone out there to do smarter things with their money, and that's what we strive for here on the show. That's why we talk about personal finance every single episode. So thanks in advance for that. But Joel, that's going to be it for this episode. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.